When writer Marge Piercy chose the book Heirlooms to be published as the winner of Bookmark Press's G.S. Sharat Chandra Prize for Short Fiction, she described it as a meditation on the meaning of family and history, a fascinating series of interconnected stories through four generations of an extended family of Jews in France, Israel, and then the U.S. before, during, and long after the Holocaust. A finalist for several other awards, in 2018, the book has won the Philip McMath Award and is runner-up for the Edward Lewis Wallant Award for Jewish Fiction. Discover why the author, Rachel Hall, who grew up in Columbia, Missouri, and now teaches at State University of New York Geneseo, decided to write her family saga of the French Resistance as fiction rather than what we call creative nonfiction, meaning memoir or personal essays. I'm Angela Elam, and we talked about this in the National Archives at Kansas City in Fall 2016 for New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at UMKC, where Rachel Hall won the magazine's fiction prize back in 2004. Here she is with an excerpt from her short story in Heirlooms called The War Ends Many Times.
Simone has placed her bags under her seat rather than struggle to lift them to the rack above. She is glad for this now as she slides the valises from beneath her. Concentrate, she tells herself. She checks the clasps to see that they are tightly fastened and follows the chemistry student out of the cabin. The aisles are filled with passengers all pushing onward, focused only on resuming their travels as soon as possible. Something, a coin, a marble, drops, and Simone hears it ping against the floor. A child cries, and she thinks of her son, Claude. It's been 3 months since she's seen him. She must get across this bridge, make her delivery, get to her son. She sees him as she left him last, on her mother's hip, his dark eyes drooping with fatigue. The suitcases feel heavy and cumbersome already. Outside, the air is moist. It will rain today, she thinks, perhaps even before she is across this bridge. Because the pedestrian bridge is narrow, there is some pushing and grumbling. Simone would rather wait until the bulk of the passengers move on, but it is difficult to slow in the crowd. She is pushed along with the others, the suitcases banging against her shins. Halfway across, the crowd thins, and she can see over the river to where the train's narrow bridge ought to be. Her arms ache, so she sets the bags down for a minute and looks. The bridge dangles like a pendant on one side. The other side is simply gone, as is the trestle and part of the hillside. There is a gash in the dark earth where it was. Bombed, she understands, and she wonders by whom. Mademoiselle, you find this amusing? Beside her is a German soldier, tall and unrumpled by travel. She is aware, then, of a faint smile on her face, not a grin. Surely she has not become so hardened to violence, such an admirer of destruction. The German is about her age, 25 or so, and unremarkable except for his eyes. Pale green, they assess Simone, take in her slim height, her blondness, but give nothing back. It doesn't look real, does it? But it is real and a terrible nuisance for those who wish to go from one place to another. Yes, of course, Simone agrees, terrible. Her heart is beating too fast. She can hear it pounding in her ears. It seems impossible that the officer doesn't hear it as well. It made me think of my son and his train set. Are you on your way to your boy then, to your family? No, I'm on my way to visit a friend who's ill. There has been no reason to lie. She is to see Claude after the drop, so why has she? Both pretty and thoughtful, the officer says, looking her straight in the eye, unsmiling. Merci, Simone says. She smiles and bends to pick up her bags. Allow me, the officer says. I'm fine, really, Simone says. You're too kind. You must save your strength for nursing your friend, he says. And for your little boy. He shakes his index finger at her as if she is a child herself. "Oh, it's you that's the thoughtful one," Simone says. "But I must warn you, the bags are heavy." The last passengers have passed them now. In the distance, Simone can hear the train she is to board. She has received training. She has been taught how to behave if she suspects danger. If the bags are inspected, if it gets to that, she is to act shocked by the contents beneath the false bottom. She should insist that she is carrying them for a friend. She imagines that fright will turn her white-faced. She could faint, if need be. But she understands this will not be necessary. The German officer has made up his mind about her in that way that people do, men do. "Good God," he says, lifting them. "What do you have in here?" "Nothing much," Simone says, "just some pistols." "And a sense of humor, too," he says, laughing. "Please," she says, "this will go to my head." Her laughter is raspy and shrill in her ears. At the train, the officer installs her in first class, though her ticket is for second only. "I'll speak to the conductor," he says. He slides her suitcase under her seat. The other passengers don't meet her eyes. She wants to protest, but of course she cannot. What would she say? She's still shaking when the train departs in the rain. She sleeps hard until Dijon wakes with a start like Claude used to when he'd cried himself to sleep. She is relieved to see her contact, whom she knows only as Monsieur Bruno, to pass on the suitcases she has brought from Lyon. It is easier when she carries documents, papers that will allow escape or an altered identity. When it is hardware, she usually adopts a kind of vagueness about what she carries, thinking only in terms of needs and supplies, a luxury, this line of thought she sees now. Even though they are out of her possession, she sees the guns clearly, their grease and heft, the steely glint of them as she drinks a coffee in the train station cafe.
That's a little passage from the book Heirlooms and the story The War Ends Many Times by Rachel Hall. And you're listening to her here on New Letters on the Air in front of an audience here at the National Archives in Kansas City. Everybody. Talk a little bit about Simone and Claude and how this story fits into this collection.
The central characters of the collection are a pair of twins, Lise and Alain, who were born in Palestine but come to France. And Lise plays a larger role in the stories. And Alain is mostly off stage, but...
He's still a big part of the collection,
right,
definitely.
Right, right. Yeah. And Simone is a girlfriend that he has who is in the French Resistance also. And she ends up getting some really horrible news about him and sort of spends the rest of her life pining for him, though she marries and has another life. But he stays very, very important to her.
Well, you did a wonderful job of setting up the tensions of what was going on during the French Resistance and how just normal, everyday people were trying to survive and a lot of people trying to escape mm-hmm. what they knew was coming down the pike. Mm-hmm. One of the things I'm interested in, because a lot of writers do not want to admit when their personal stories creep into their work. And you're the opposite. You're proud that this is based on family stories. Can you talk about why you decided to write it as fiction as opposed to trying to do a family memoir?
Primarily, I just like fiction more. That's the genre that I'm the most comfortable with. But in a way, the reemergence maybe of the genre of creative nonfiction has made this more of a issue or topic because fiction writers have long written from their life, you know, like Hemingway. And it just seems like nobody questioned that. And it seems like because we're reading so much creative nonfiction and we're teaching creative nonfiction in graduate programs and undergraduate programs, that suddenly then the question arises, like, why didn't you write this as creative nonfiction? I also didn't really want to be in it. And I think if you're writing a family memoir, that the narrator, the person who's lived it or is close to it, is somehow in it. And I sort of wanted to, you know, not be in it and tell the stories through these other characters' eyes. So that meant fiction, really. Yeah.
Even though there is a granddaughter who lives in Columbia, Missouri, is she kind of based on you?
She might be a little bit. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did you get a lot of stories from your grandmother?
Both from her and my grandfather, who are really my mother's adoptive parents, her aunt and uncle. I knew them all my life as my grandparents.
Which is how it happens in the book as well.
And my grandmother, who was an artist, had gone to France to study art, although that's not what she did there. She and my grandfather had been working in a lab in Paris, and instead of studying art, she'd gotten a law degree. But she was a person with a lot of feelings and didn't seem to be highly rational or analytical. And yet she knew when she was told to go to City Hall to register that that was not something that she should do. And so her instincts were very right. And so they were not registered, and I'm sure they had false papers.
And then that ends up in the book, mm-hmm. Yeah.
You may know that foreign Jews were the most endangered in France initially. And my grandmother was married to a Frenchman who had been raised Catholic, and I think that protected her a great deal. Also, she had already become a French citizen by the time the war started, so that protected her too. So my grandmother would tell the stories, and she would talk about how she responded. And my grandfather had all the facts, and he would say, you know, what year something happened. And so together they were quite a combination.
How old were you when they passed away?
My grandmother lived to 103.
Oh, my word.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. She died in 2010. She knew all of her great-grandchildren, and yeah.
Did she tell you stories as you were looking at photographs?
Yeah, they always had photo albums, and I don't know when I first started looking at them, but I just always remember being interested in them. So I would say, well, what's this? Where is this? And I think, you know, maybe like memory, what perks your interest at a particular time is different too. So I would notice one thing at one time, and she would tell a story about that. There's a photograph of my mother as a pretty young baby, maybe not even a year old, in a little wooden walker, and someone has scrawled the date, and it's 1939, and you can't look at that now and think, who bought that walker? Who bought those baby booties? Somebody had to care for a child while this war was about to strike. So, you know, I didn't really notice that picture as a girl, but then when I had a child, that really struck me. I thought it was hard enough to have an infant in peacetime in America. So it's hard to imagine doing it under those circumstances.
Yeah. Rachel Hall's book of stories called Heirlooms. We have some photographs that actually influenced her, so I thought it would be kind of fun to see a few of them. And she really has built on some of these.
Okay.
And then it'll also give our radio audience just a chance to imagine this. Because we can't show them these pictures on the radio anyway.
We can
on our website, newletters.org.
So these are my mother's biological parents, Eve and Esther.
And Esther is Esther in the book. You didn't change her name.
I didn't. She's the only one I didn't. That's interesting because I think because I never knew her, she's always been sort of fictional to me anyway. And this is one of the few photographs we have of her, really. And actually, she looks kind of different in all of them, so
You use that line in the book, too.
I scoured them to see, like, who is this person, you know? And this is the photograph that I was mentioning before of my mother in her little walker. And she's got chubby little legs, and she looks a little scared. But I think that's probably from the camera flashing rather than an awareness of the impending world disaster. But cute, right? Very cute.
Very cute.
This is the De Burton children in Palestine. The character Liz is based on the young lady with the bow in her hair, the shorter one, Elise, and then Elan is based on Eve, and he's on the furry stool. And Allegra is the older girl behind, and based on my great aunt Marguerite. And the character of Rosa is not mentioned in the collection at all. So there were 5 children in total, but in the fictional version, there's just 3.
Yeah.
So this photograph is one of my favorites. And this is my grandmother, Elise, again, Liz. This is a Purim costume that she made. And we think she was probably 16 or 17.
It's yeah. really fun. Actually, she's got a tiny passage in here that uses this. Why don't we get you to read that?
All right. This is from the story After All. In her last days, when they no longer try to lure her from her narrow bed, she hears singing, lullabies like those her mother sang to her in Ladino or Hebrew, the melody soft and bright. "Don't you hear it?" she asks the night nurse, a tall, dark man with the gentlest hands and improbably a gold hoop in one ear. A gentle pirate, or perhaps he's in costume for Purim, her favorite holiday. But the night nurse, his name escapes her, has taken her temperature and blood pressure and departed, so she cannot ask him. In the morning, she will locate her butterfly costume, the wings she made from wire and muslin and a special iridescent paint, the cap with its curled antenna. It was her best. She will offer it to her granddaughter, Sophie, who should get out more. She's always sitting around here. "Go on," Lise will tell her, handing over the shimmering costume. "Dance." Oh, that's nice. Thank you.
That's just the beginning of the short story, After All, in Heirlooms, winner of the G.S. Sharat Chander Prize for Short Fiction, selected by Marge Piercy, and this is New Letters on the Air at the National Archives in Kansas City. You mentioned Ladino, the mm-hmm. language.
Right.
So you might explain what that is.
Oh, okay, right. So Ladino is Old Spanish, and it's the language that the Jews from the Iberian Peninsula spoke. It's sort of like the Yiddish of Sephardic
Spain.
Jews,
right?
And that's what my grandmother's family spoke in Israel, which was Palestine at the time. It was her first language, and I actually never heard her speak it. But when I was doing some research, I went to the Ladino Preservation website, and they had audio tapes, and you could listen to people speaking. And I felt like I should understand because it sounded so much like my grandmother in the way that she spoke English and the way that she spoke French. There was a sort of a rhythm and a kind of accent, like some rolling R's. And she put her own touch on those languages, I guess. So that was her first language. And I wish now very much that she taught us and that we knew that, but we don't.
Right.
So.
Your research, how did you go about doing that?
I read a lot of journals, and these were not family journals, but the journal of Helene Baer was really useful. There's another journal by a woman, I can't remember her name, but it's called Resistance, and she was in the French Resistance. And she sort of makes an argument that I could understand for joining the resistance and risking your life. And she said she was looking for people with whom she could speak her mind. And in the rest of her world, they couldn't say anything about Vichy or the Germans. And so she sought out other people with whom she could be honest and talk about things that were disturbing her. And I thought, yeah, I get that. Like, that would make me risk life too, I think, to find people with whom you could really talk in a time like that when you're terrified.
At what point did you realize you had a book here?
Well, I wrote the first story that's in the book first, and I kind of thought I was done. And I had a sabbatical from the college where I teach, and I was working on another project about the Oneida community, which was a religious utopian community in Western New York. And suddenly I thought, oh, I have to write this other story. So I kind of took a break from that project and quickly wrote what is the last story in this collection. And then I realized I had bookends. And then I just stopped doing the Oneida community and went with this. I hope to get back to them someday. They're pretty interesting. But yeah, yeah.
All of these stories stand alone. You could just read one of the stories and be fine and not have to read the rest of it to get a sense of what you're doing with your writing, which I think is really wonderful. But then when you read this entire book, you look at truth or what the story is from all different directions. And so you start questioning which is the right story.
Yeah, that's sort of what I'm most interested in, is who tells the story and how it gets shaped. And not that people are intentionally dishonest, but we notice different things and perceive things so differently. So that was one of the things I was really interested in exploring. And I'm glad that you say they stand on their own and that they also build. So that was what I really was hoping for.
Yeah, I think it worked really well. There's a point later in the book when the granddaughter, who's in Colombia, who may or may not be like you, there's a lovely echo, and I'm not going to give it away because it's a wonderful thing to discover as you read it, that seems so much the truth of what actually happens. And then when it gets told by the grandmother much later, it's changed in a way that's really intriguing, because reality is so fluid sometimes with stories, and especially family stories.
Right. Yeah, I mean, probably lots of people have had the experience of some kind of family event, and then later they'll say, well, do you remember when so-and-so did this, and the rest of the family doesn't remember it or remembers it completely differently? You know, in real life, it's very frustrating to not have your memories validated, but it makes for interesting fiction. So.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? You use letters a lot in this book because, you know, that's how we knew the world.
I guess that's another thing, the letters sometimes. You wonder how truthful the letters were, the real letters. Were they trying to protect family at home? And
it also just reminds you what a different world it was.
Right, and the geographic distance. I mean, now there's no geographic distance, right? Because there's texting and Facebook and whatever.
And everything's so immediate now. There is later on in the book a passage. It's interesting because it ties into what we were talking about with truth, but from yet another angle. We're just picking up in the middle of this story, White Lies, that's included in Rachel Hall's book of stories called Heirlooms. A telegram has arrived, and it's September 30th, 1944, with deep sadness, stop, Alain dead, stop, Jean, stop.
So this is a telegram coming from Jean, who is married to Lise, and he's writing to Lise's family in Palestine about Alain, because they've discovered that Alain was killed.
And remember, Lise and Alain are the twins.
And Lise and Alain's older sister, Allegra, intercepts the telegram that's come primarily for her mother. It's immediate, her decision not to tell Mama. No, she can't bear it. Allegra is glad her marketing bags are by the door, so she has only to grab them, slip on her shoes, and shout in her departure. She folds the telegram into her pocket and then leaves at a brisk pace, as if she can outrun the news, the black cloud of it hovering above her. Gone. Her brother is gone. It is impossible to accept such a thing. For so long, he's been in France that now she imagines him there still in the apartment she's only seen in photos, or walking the broad boulevards of Paris, far away certainly, but not forever. Mama had been counting on his coming back. That was the plan all along. France for medical school and then home to practice. And now, with the war nearly over, they'd been expecting to hear from him, but not like this, never like this. Allegra has walked too far somehow and passed the entrance to the market. She doesn't know where she is. The city grows and changes so quickly. The street she's on ends abruptly with a pile of rubble. She's sweating, though it's not a warm day. She leans against the building for a moment, wipes her face. She has to turn around and retrace her steps. What to do? Jewish law prescribes such matters. The body of the deceased must be watched over until the burial, which should happen quickly. Then Shiva, the days of silence and mourning, with family and then with friends, and all that food, as if chewing and swallowing were a way of grieving. And perhaps they are, reminding us as they do that we are alive, though our loved one is not. As for the living, their anxieties are to be eased. And isn't that precisely what Allegra intends to do? Poor Mama, she thinks. It's been 2 years since Papa died. That loss still fresh. To lose a child in addition is too much. Allegra remembers then something Mama would say to her when she was a girl, and she was to mind the others, make sure they were quiet in synagogue or had their lessons done for the tutor, that no one was hurt or lost. The fish goes rotten from the head, and you are the head. She hasn't been paying attention, and look what has happened. She will write back tout de suite to Jean and Lise and tell them that Mama can't bear the news just yet. Eventually, Mama will expect more correspondence from Hélène, Allegra understands, but she will worry about that later. For a while, a certain degree of fudging works. For instance, a letter from Le Puy is written by Jean on behalf of all of them. And then, of course, after a war, one must expect delays and distraction. Employment must be found, a new apartment, a new school for the child. On Hélène and Lise's birthday, Allegra suggests they send only cards rather than risk a package getting lost in the upheaval. Of course, it will require some explaining when Lise and Jean and the girl arrive, not to stay, as Allegra had hoped, but to visit before moving to America. Mama will want to know why Hélène hasn't come, too. Some of this might be explained away by the distance, the expense of 4 tickets rather than 3. Allegra is beginning to see the way her lie requires tending. It's a finicky plant, one that needs to be moved into the sun, then out, given just the right amount of water. Too little and it droops, too much it bolts, grows straggly and weak. Even carefully looked after, its buds might shrivel and drop.
Rachel Hall, in the National Archives at Kansas City in fall 2016, after Bookmark Press published Heirlooms as the winner of the G.S. Sharat Chandra Prize for Fiction. In 2018, the book has won the Philip McMath Award and is runner-up for the Edward Lewis Wallen Award for Jewish Fiction. We just heard excerpts from the story White Lies, first published in New Letters magazine. For links to Heirlooms and some of the family photos that inspired Rachel Hall, go to newletters.org and click On the Air, a production of UMKC with support from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Today's show was produced with Mackenzie Callahan, Luke McKitty, Megan Schwindler, Claire Verbeck, and Jamie Walsh. Thanks also to Bookmark's Ben Furnish and Cynthia Beard, and National Archives' Kimberly Reed, and to you for listening to New Letters on the Air. I'm Angela Elam.